to the Critical Care Obstetrics podcast on invasive group A strep. My name is Suzanne McMurtry Baird. I'm the nursing director at Clinical Concepts in Obstetrics, and I'm here with my partner, Stephanie Martin, the medical director at Clinical Concepts. Today, we are going to be talking about invasive group A strep infection, or also known as necrotizing fasciitis. Many of you that are listening will have some experience with this and viscerally understand how aggressive and humbling this disease can be. These patients will degenerate so rapidly, so you must have a high index of suspicion, recognize it early, and intervene aggressively before you even confirm what you're exactly dealing with. So before we get into some key concepts, I just want to tell everybody that I have my two dogs in here. They're big boxers, and I'm just hoping that nobody from FedEx shows up or something. And Stephanie, you have an animal in your library, too.
I've got a new kitty named Peanut Butter, and he doesn't like to leave my side. So I was nervous if I put him outside the room, I'd probably have more ruckus than if I just let him take his nap here. So hopefully he cooperates.
And he doesn't get on your keyboard, because you know how cats like to just crawl over everything. And then all of a sudden you leave us in the middle of this. So anyway, so if you hear some barking or kitty cats, well, you know why. But anyway, let's get back to what we're going to talk about. Before we get into some of the pathophysiology, I want to give you a summary and some of the key concepts that we want you to take away from this discussion on group A strep sepsis. And we've developed another acronym. So our acronym for group A strep sepsis, besides GAS, is how we're going to manage and how we're going to assess for this. So our acronym is WAR. WAR, starting with W, is weird, wild, pain. So when you see a patient, especially in the postpartum period, that has pain out of proportion to your examination or what you would expect a patient to be having during that condition or time frame, think about group A strep sepsis and act quickly. A then will stand for aggressive intervention. So that will be your source control or eliminating the suspected source of the infection. And that's a huge crucial step. And that may include surgical interventions that may be necessary, like a hysterectomy, or even if the patient is unstable or in shock, you have to remove the source. And again, that may be by surgical. And then making the decision in these situations to be aggressive can be a very difficult decision, especially if it involves something like a hysterectomy. So aggressive intervention is the A, and then R, rapid progression. That's why early recognition is so essential to the suspicion with that weird, wild pain, because you need to intervene quickly. And survival and morbidity is and mortality is dependent upon that rapid progression and your rapid intervention. And it spreads so quickly, even right in front of your eyes. And then waiting for confirmation, if you sit back, you know, again, you're going to increase your morbidity and mortality. So, Stephanie, why don't we get into, before we get into like a case discussion, why don't you take a minute to review some background information on group A strep?
Yeah, I'll never forget the first time that I encountered group A strep. I was a medical student and I was assigned to go do a history and physical on a gentleman in the emergency department. And he had these purple spots on his flank area. Of course, I'm a medical student, so it takes me a good long time to do a history and physical. And so it was probably an hour that I was there with the patient before I go to present with the attending. And when we come back into the room and we examine him again together, these purple spots have coalesced and dramatically increased in size. And that gentleman had necrotizing fasciitis from group A strep. And I have never forgotten that. In an obstetrics, it's a little bit different. It's not typically on the flank. It's not typically so easy to see. It may be internal very often and much more challenging to diagnose. But group A strep, also called strep pyogenes, is actually extremely common. This is what causes skin and soft tissue infections like strep throat, which we've all had at some point in our life, and impetigo, which is a skin infection that toddlers and young children often get on their face in particular. But sometimes that superficial infection or that superficial colonization even can become invasive, and it leads to severe disease, including shock, necrotizing fasciitis, and toxic shock syndrome. Now, if we look at women around the time of childbirth, about 80% of peripartum invasive group A strep infection is from contact with contacts who have it, who may not be that sick at all or completely asymptomatic. It could be a child that has a strep throat or just colonized with group A strep, or another family member or contact. And pregnant and postpartum women seem to be particularly susceptible to it converting to an invasive form and not just becoming a typical strep throat or other benign cellulitis. In fact, most invasive group A strep in that peripartum patient is actually after delivery. And the risk is about 20-fold higher in the postpartum period than when they're not pregnant. And when you look at women who die from postpartum sepsis, about half are from invasive group A strep. So if you've never seen it or you don't have experience with it, make no mistake, invasive group A strep is your worst nightmare and your patient's worst nightmare. Now, when we look at who's at risk for developing the invasive form, there's quite a few risk factors. First, the mom herself may have strep throat and be symptomatic or asymptomatic, but she may have strep throat herself that then leads to it becoming invasive in another area, not necessarily in the pharynx itself. Having contact with young children during pregnancy, and this is an underappreciated risk factor for the maternal source for group A strep. One other reason this may be a risk factor is because, you know, the rate of having group A strep colonization without overt infection is much higher in children than it is in adults. So if that pregnant woman has children at home or works around children or is exposed to children, she's more likely to acquire the group A strep, and then for some reason it becomes invasive in her more commonly when she's pregnant or postpartum. Any invasive or surgical procedures, such as a cesarean birth, is going to increase the risk that it becomes invasive. Preterm premature rupture of membranes. Think that patient who maybe has a mid-trimester rupture of membranes, 18 or 20 weeks gestation, and then remains pregnant. That's a portal for group A strep to enter and become invasive. The patient who has retained products of conception, especially if she goes home and then comes back with a subsequent infection. And then, as always, any woman who has a comorbid condition such as diabetes or obesity or any chronic disease, kidneys in particular, is going to increase their risk of becoming septic from any cause, but particularly group A strep becoming invasive. Interestingly, in one retrospective study, having a first pregnancy, so women in their first pregnancy, may in fact be at lower risk for postpartum invasive group A strep. And that supports the idea that asymptomatic colonization or children that are carrying group A strep are a significant risk factor. So presumably those patients who are in their first pregnancy have less exposure to children in the home, in theory, and therefore are less likely to develop an invasive group A strep. Now, Suzanne, why don't you take us through an actual case and let's talk about what the issues are with this patient, her presentation, and what the opportunities might have been to improve her outcome.
Yeah, let's do that because, again, early recognition and aggressive intervention is key. And because death can occur within 24 hours of symptom onset. And so you have to have that high suspicion, you know, index of suspicion early. and early administration of antibiotic therapy that would cover group A strep, and then prompt diagnosis and surgical debridement, including hysterectomy, which may be necessary. And then all of that could be life-saving. So see if you could recognize this in this patient. So this patient was 29 years old, so not your very, older women or younger women, you know, right there in the middle, 29 years old, gravid of 3, para 2002. She'd had 2 previous spontaneous vaginal births that she described as quick and painless labor. I don't know about you, but I didn't have quick or painless labor. So that just gives me a suspicion of this patient has a really high pain tolerance. You know, not to be assumed that she'll have that in this labor, but it does tell me about something about how she labors and how she perceives pain. So her current pregnancy, she had no risk factors and was seeing a certified nurse midwife for her pregnancy. And she comes in at like 38 2/7 weeks in labor. She's 4 centimeters, 100% effaced, -1, and she has spontaneous rupture of membranes at home. So I know all of you are thinking, wow, I wish all of my patients would come in like that. Fetal heart rate strip looked fabulous. Her vital signs were 98.1. Her heart rate was 84. Her blood pressure was 123/75. And her respirations were 20. So 3 hours after admission, she is another spontaneous vaginal delivery by the certified nurse midwife. She had no episiotomy and no lacerations that were noted, and no analgesia or anesthesia during her labor. So fast forward to postpartum day 2. So you've got a patient that is scheduled to go home on this day. And during the first postpartum day, she had spiked a temp at, or T-max was like 100.6. And they treated that with Tylenol, and she increased her oral fluids, and she had no other spikes in temp, which I think is a really important fact in these patients. Is these patients at the beginning and when they are starting this process may not run these 103 temps like you might see in a pediatric patient. I know that because I used to work pediatrics outpatient. It's my first nursing job. And I would see these children come in and they would run these really high temps with strep throat infections. And even if it had progressed to like scarlet fever. But these patients may or may not have these, you know, really, really high temps that will alert you and get a lot of attention if they're, you know, spiking around a 103. But this patient, T-max was 100.6. She had complained of some cramping, and she had described it as afterbirth pains, which is nothing unusual, right? And she had been treated with Motrin or ibuprofen for that. And then she started having these weird, wild symptoms. So the first weird, wild symptom she had is she started complaining of itching. And they have a lot of documentation in the chart about how they were, you know, it could be the bed sheets, it could be the linens, it could be, you know, what could it be? There's no medications. But the bottom line was they gave her Benadryl. Then she started complaining of burning with urination. So there was this great discussion in the medical record about, could this be a UTI? She didn't have any risk factors except for being pregnant, right? But could it be also related to urine that hit her tissue on her perineum that may have had some micro lacerations in the tissue? And could it be burning with micturition or when that urine hit her perineum? So there was this great discussion about how they were going to observe, and if she continued to have discomfort when she urinated, that they would do a UA on the patient. And then she started complaining of another weird wild symptom, and that was these severe cramps. And it was so high. Her pain was like 7 out of 10 and 8 out of 10, which was a lot different than what she was describing the pain of labor contractions. So like the highest max she had gotten as far as pain during labor was 7 out of 10. Now she is postpartum day 2 and she's 7 out of 10, and then she's 8 out of 10, and they give her some, an analgesic with that had Tylenol in it. So, that could mask attempt, but same thing with the ibuprofen. But this is just continuing on, and she's saying, I feel like I'm having a baby. It continued, and then it got up to 10 out of 10. So that was really weird and wild for this patient. So the nurse went and got another nurse and said, hey, can you come in and check this patient with me? She is grabbing at my hand. She's guarding her abdomen. She's catching her breath with the exam. And then that second RN comes in, does an assessment, and they call the midwife. And about that time, the patient starts vomiting again, which I think is also another weird, wild symptom for this patient. She, out of the blue, starts having vomiting where she had not complained of nausea or, you know, anything like that. And even the medication had been given so far in the past that it wasn't, you know, any medication that she had taken. I don't know why, but they treated her with Maalox. That would kind of make me vomit. But the midwife is on the way to the hospital to come in. So they called the midwife. The midwife said, okay, I'm coming in because this is weird, wild stuff. And even on the way to the hospital, the midwife called the physician and said, hey, you know, this is what's going on with the patient. I'm going in to assess her, and then I'll give you a call. So they drew some labs and see what you think. Her hematocrit is 35.3. And if you look at your trends in your labs, in this patient, her postpartum day one hematocrit had been 32.1. And now it's 35.3. So that should give you some suspicion that this patient is hemoconcentrated, and that this is a concern when you start thinking about an infection or possible progression to sepsis, that this patient may be intravascularly volume depleted. But the other components were just as concerning, or more so. Her platelet count is now down to 114,000, and her white cells are 2.3. Unfortunately, they did not do a differential at that time and did not call down to the lab to do a differential.
I'm going to predict that had they done a differential, there would have been a pretty significant left shift with a high number of bands, because a low white count like this tells you that she's mounting a massive response to infection. And a low white count is not reassuring. It tells you that she's essentially running out of white blood cells and can't keep up with the war. She's losing the war. So little baby soldiers are coming out to try and fight this war. So that would be my prediction. It's too bad that we don't have it. And as you've pointed out before, Suzanne, you can always call the lab after the fact and say, add on a differential. So you may not have realized it wasn't ordered properly, or maybe you didn't suspect an infection until you get the CBC back. You can always call the lab and say, hey, please do a differential on that sample.
That's right. And it does. It tells you where they are in the process, too. So if you think about early stages of an infection, your white cells go up. And then when you start lowering your number and get to this low of a 2.3, you've run out of white cells. So thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah. So in terms of sepsis, to highlight what we're seeing here, because this patient is entering sepsis at this point, it's not confirmed yet by labs, but you're seeing diffuse endothelial damage that's resulting in leaky capillaries. So fluid is leaking out of the vessels. The patient's becoming hemoconcentrated. It's also leading to platelet clumping and consumption. So the platelet count will go down. At the same time, the white cells are being utilized excessively and she's running out. So if you know what you're looking for, these labs are giving you a big clue.
Right. So now the midwife is at the bedside and, you know, we have these labs back. The patient is continuing with that weird, wild pain to where now they're going to give her some morphine to control the pain and help with that and get a CT. And the CT was ordered with contrast. And that will be a point later on. So just remember that it was a CT with contrast. They put a Foley catheter in the patient and she has dark, concentrated golden urine in a low amount. So again, another key non-invasive assessment that may indicate a intravascular volume depletion, which is associated with a septic picture. So the CT results come back and they don't see any infection in her abdomen. So it's not a uterine infection. It's a somewhere else, obviously. And they call the physician, give the physician a report. But here are her vital signs now. So we're now into that next day postpartum. And her temp is 98.2. Her heart rate, though, is 133. Her respirations are 18, which I wonder about that value, but documented as 18. And her blood pressure is 92 over 48. Again, another sign that this could be sepsis. The physician comes in a few hours later and doesn't write a progress note, which is not relative to the outcome. Everybody said this physician was there, but was just relying on the midwife and the notes that the midwife had put into the chart. So I just want to make a point about documentation. It's essential that all of the care providers for this patient document a full assessment and a plan of care and what you're suspecting as your diagnosis. Why is this patient in so much pain? Why is her lab, are her labs abnormal? Why are her vital signs abnormal now? Why is her urine output down? What is going on? And at that time, the physician says, you know, you don't really need that Foley. So they discontinue the Foley. They give her some Ducalox, a suppository for the abdominal pain. So as I'm reviewing this, I'm thinking, that is a symptom, right, of her infection, and they're treating symptoms. But again, no one has made the connection that this patient has an infection and that she is septic. Again, with these early warning signs and now more advanced warning signs. A little later on, the patient starts complaining of, another weird, wild symptom. And that was numbness and tingling in her left foot. The nurse does an excellent assessment and says that she has positive pedal pulses bilaterally and that she has good perfusion, but she's still concerned and calls the physician because the patient is still have that weird, wild pain. She's moaning and rolling around in the bed. And she's called the other RN in to assess her again because, again, this is abnormal for this patient. Think back, painless childbirth and painless labor and delivery. And that's how she's describing her pain now, is rolling around and moaning.
I just wanted to kind of expand a little bit on the imaging and everything that was done before. Clearly, this team is not considering the possibility that this patient is infected, much less that she could be infected with group A strep. But let's flip it and say maybe they did suspect that this is group A strep and they're wondering, well, what do we do now? Because we've got a patient who is critically ill. She's deteriorating literally in front of their eyes, and we'll get more information about that in a minute. But the purpose of the imaging was a good thing to do. She needed to be imaged in some way. We needed to figure out what's going on in this belly to understand why this patient is in so much pain. But with group A strep, your imaging may not be as helpful as you want it to be unless you see a gross evidence of infection like an abscess or free air or even gas or air in the myometrium itself, for example. So if you suspect group A strep, this patient is deteriorating in front of you, you've got weird, wild pain, vital sign changes, lab abnormalities, this is a situation where you may be forced to make a decision to do a hysterectomy without definitive proof of what you're dealing with. And that's extremely difficult. I've had many people call me asking me, what would you do? And they're literally at the bedside taking care of the patient saying, I'm not sure what to do next. And my response is, hang up the phone, go to the operating room, take out her uterus. You can call me from the OR, but you've got to get going. The longer you wait, the worse things are going to be. At minimum, you have to open the patient and assess the uterus because it may not be possible to confirm the uterus as the source without doing a surgery. And very often in these postpartum patients, the uterus is the culprit or the vaginal perineum area if they had lacerations or episiotomies. But if you don't see obvious evidence of necrotizing tissue and you suspect group A strep, you may have to open them up to figure it out, which is extremely difficult to do when you're not 100% certain.
So let's continue. The patient is, you know, again, still moaning and rolling in the bed, and they give her some pain meds, draw some more labs, and now her hematocrit is at 36.8. So you, again, you're seeing this hematocrit go up even higher than when she was, you know, came in into labor. And her platelets are now down to 84,000, and her white blood cell count is 1.9. Again, it was just ordered as a CBC, and a differential was not drawn. So for the pain, the abdominal pain that this patient was having, they decide to give her a Fleet's enema. She had no results from the enema. Now, why would that be? Could it be that she's septic and her cardiac output is not perfusing her gut, and that's not the issue, right? But they phoned the physician, and now we get an MFM consult. So, Stephanie, what, I mean, in this scenario, you're an MFM. When do you want to be called on this patient?
I want to be called early in the process. I mean, initially when the midwife assessed that patient and found abnormalities, if they're going to be ordering a CT like that, they've got, you know, weird, wild pain, this patient who's got abnormal vital signs, abnormal labs, I want to be involved early. I want to be part of the decision to do the CT. I don't need to be involved after the CT's done. That's all. That's great. But I want to be involved earlier. And then once you get the CT, then get me involved immediately. A negative CT doesn't mean we don't have an issue here. This patient is atypical. Different things are happening. It's not easily explained by a normal postpartum course. So get us involved earlier so that we can weigh in and give some perspective. Postpartum does not mean there's not a role for a maternal fetal medicine physician. Just because they're no longer pregnant does not mean that we don't have something to offer. So please, please, please get us involved early.
Who else would you want to get involved? In this case, they got infectious disease and general surgery also consulted.
I mean, that's reasonable to do that, but in this case, they pretty much consulted everybody all at the same time, which shows to me that they're panicking because they don't understand what is happening. Well, fine, get people involved. But if I'd been involved early, I probably would have gotten her into the ICU and gotten an intensivist involved and then determined what our course of action would be in order to achieve source control. And so I may not involve general surgery because I'm not necessarily thinking about, you know, a gut source or a general surgery, something that I need a general surgeon to perform the surgery. But I might have a low threshold to get infectious disease involved if I suspect group A strep so that I can have more expertise. But at minimum, intensivist and possibly infectious disease and general surgery, depending on what the source is suspected to be. If I need to do a big perineal debridement, I'm going to get general surgery and or my oncologist involved, someone who can do these large debridement areas. I'm not going to do that myself. But if it's a hysterectomy, I'm probably going to be doing it.
And this patient continued to, you know, decompensate. They put a Foley back in the patient. She had no urine return. So she's anuric at this point. The shift change assessment comes up, and it's night shift now. She's 98.8. So again, noting this patient never had this, you know, big spike in temp, but her heart rate is 153, her respiratory rate is 32, and her blood pressure is 88 over 52 with a pulse ox of 78%.
Yeah, I want to comment on some of these vital signs. So this patient is now clearly septic and septic shock likely, but she's this tachycardia. Let's go through these vital signs one at a time because you know we love some vital signs. She's tachycardic not because there's a problem with her heart, because she has a perfectly normal, healthy heart that is doing everything in its power to maintain cardiac output as her mean arterial pressure drops and her systemic vascular resistance drops. The SATs of 78%, this patient does not have pneumonia. She probably doesn't have pulmonary edema. This is likely a perfusion problem where she is simply not perfusing her tissues. It is not a problem with your pulse oximeter. It's real. Trust it. Believe it. But in praise of the respiratory rate, I will give this team one thing. They were doing respiratory rates and documenting them at least, because we're always in search of a respiratory rate. But tachypnea is often the first sign you will see that the patient is trying to compensate as she's becoming acidotic. So respiratory rates will go up as the patient tries to blow off CO2 because she's becoming progressively acidotic from sepsis or septic shock or whatever the cause may be, diabetic ketoacidosis, but not in this case. Yeah, and it could also be because she's in horrific pain. Right. But, you know, all those things together, you have to think critically. At 32, a respiratory rate is not normal. There is something pathologic going on.
Well, the fact that her heart's beating that fast, or she's breathing that fast, and she's in that much pain, she's going to use up a lot of oxygen. But I'd still, if I got a pulse ox of 78, you want to make sure that you're listening to breath sounds. And is that consistent? And then adding oxygen for this patient, because she is utilizing so much that you do not want a pulse ox of 78. So could it be pulmonary edema? Yeah, it could be. It would be a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema that she may show you these signs and symptoms with her vital signs before you see anything on the chest x-ray. So, you know, make sure that you're remembering that part of it.
That's a really good point, because in OB, we think, generally speaking, we see a decreased O2 sat and we think she's hypoxemic because she has got a lung problem that's not allowing her to oxygenate well. And that is absolutely a possibility here. She could have non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, but there's other things that go into what your SATs are, and that, you know, perfusion is one of them and consumption is the other. And there are other things as well, but those are the big things. So yes, we need to work up her lungs and image her lungs and figure out what's going on there, because she's certainly got risk factors. But as Suzanne said, there's other things that contribute to that. So think critically about that. No matter the cause, she needs supplemental oxygen.
Right. And the next thing is that in that aggressive management is starting antibiotics. And you've seen the delay in this case of starting antibiotics, and they finally start them and cover the group A strep. But this is laid into the picture, and the patient is then transferred to the ICU. The outcome for this is not great. She survived, but this patient lost 4 of her limbs due to group A strep sepsis. And that is a possibility even with the top aggressive management in these patients. They can still have really bad outcomes and have morbidity and mortality even when you treat aggressively. So early is the key. So let's think about this case and discuss it. First off, the signs and symptoms of group A strep. Weird, wild pain outside of norms. And again, they don't have to spike a huge temp. But what are your symptoms telling you? What are your labs telling you? That low white count, the decreasing platelets, the increasing hematocrit levels. There was no differential done with the white cells. There was no lactate drawn on this patient that would be in your maternal sepsis bundles. And they didn't start those antibiotics until the patient was in shock. They didn't respond to those non-invasive hemodynamic assessments, like the vital signs, like the urine output and the urine color, the concentration of the urine, and the weird, wild pain. They gave meds. They gave an enema. They gave Maalox. They gave these things, but they didn't give the antibiotics. And they didn't treat the cause or even determine the cause. So those are the keys with the with this case. So just to tie everything up, I want you to remember our acronym again. And that's WAR. War on Group A Strep. That weird, wild pain. A for aggressive intervention. And R for rapid progression. Let's go to war on Group A Strep sepsis. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. You can learn more about our company at www.clinicalconceptsnob.com. You can also follow us on our Facebook page, which is Clinical Concepts in Obstetrics. We're also on Twitter at OB Critical Care and on Instagram at Critical Care OB. Email us and send us some direct messages for some suggestions of our future podcast. We appreciate all of our listeners and have a great day.
This podcast was produced by Austin Baird. Are you looking to create a podcast? Please email me at podcastnashville@gmail.com. That is podcastnashville@gmail.com.